The Canby Report was produced and recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem peoples.
It is Tuesday, July 6th, and there are 466 days until the Vancouver municipal elections. This is the Canby Report. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield. It's been hot out. I think it's been hot out. Are you doing okay?
I'm managing. I spent a good deal of last week just sitting in a bathtub full of cold water, so I suppose I've found a way to deal with it in lieu of having, you know, air conditioning or anything like that.
Oh, you mean this miraculous cold breeze that's blowing down on me from the vent above into my basement, and because our vents aren't aligned quite right, it's like 18 in here and 24 in the rest of the house?
Yeah, that's the one.
Highly recommend.
I set up a swamp cooler for a little while. If anyone doesn't know how to do this, just put a bunch of plates of water out in front of a fan and just blow the water over it. They've been using this technology since ancient Egypt, and it actually does really work. Now, however, because we had to record, I've closed all the windows, and so the house is a sweatbox.
Well, let's make this one a quick one, then. We have to start, as always, by begging for money. You can give us some at patreon.com/CanbyReport.
Yes, that's patreon.com/CanbyReport, the number one source for citizen journalism in Vancouver. Help us continue to provide coverage of the hot, hot news right off the presses. At, once again, patreon.com/CanbyReport.
Yeah, we got lots to cover today, so maybe let's get into it. And we'll start with the heat wave, because I think there is some local municipal news and angles to that beyond just how uncomfortable so many people were or how we had to stay indoors for yet another reason.
Yeah, and I think notably amongst that is that during some of the heat wave, Oppenheimer Park was closed. Now, Oppenheimer Park, as many of you will remember, is the site of a tent city that has been the site of a number of controversies over the past year, including a shooting death and a number of overdoses. It initially was closed during the hottest days, but was partially opened following protests.
Yeah. The park had been closed off since they evicted campers there in May 2020. Following that, many people were found housing, but others moved to Strathcona Park, where they were eventually evicted, where some were found housing and some always refused. There's always a bit of challenge with that, and we've covered that in the past. But part of the promise of closing off Oppenheimer Park was that once the park had been revitalized, they would start to reopen it. And after a year had passed, it still hadn't been reopened. And so it got to the hottest days of the year, and people started pointing out that there are a lot of people still living rough in the downtown east side, people who don't have shelter or don't have places to be during the day. And if it's 40 degrees out and you're in an alley of concrete and glass, I can't imagine how awful that would be. And even like the shade of a tree was still hot those days. It was still unbearable, but it was slightly less unbearable, and that wasn't made available right away.
Yeah, and I think that's a failure on the part of the Parks Board, yet another failure on the part of the Parks Board. It's important that these urban heat sinks, it's technically not an urban heat sink, but it's these places where there is slightly less concentration of heat are open as amenities during times like this. Now, it's not the only thing that the city did. The city opened a number of cooling centers across Metro Vancouver, across the city of Vancouver, to house people. A lot of libraries and community centers served these purposes for people like myself who don't have air conditioning in their houses.
Yeah, and, you know, thankfully some of the COVID restrictions had loosened and you could have guests over, and so we did welcome a couple friends who are in our neighborhood over to give them some reprieve for an afternoon. You know, their comment was, we didn't realize we'd be climate refugees.
Dark.
Yeah. It's between that and I don't think we'll quite touch on the news out of Lytton directly, but you know, it was a rough couple weeks of that heat plus the additional residential school findings. So it's been hard.
Yeah, it's a cruel summer to be sure. But there is still a election in the offing. Not close in the offing, mind you, but Team Kennedy is now a go.
So we had this kind of teased by a couple polls, including notably the one we received that was commissioned by the Kennedy-Stewart campaign, that posed the question of what would voters think of a Team Kennedy-Stewart slate in comparison to the other municipal offerings that are out there. And hypotheticals poll very well, so well in fact, that apparently it's now a thing, and Kennedy Stewart has released a video and some media statements saying he is looking for a few good people to run under his name.
Can we just start commissioning polls that say, like, how do you feel about moral leadership in the mayor's office? Good? Good? Would it be good? And then maybe having seen that poll, as he did for this mayoral run and this apparently next mayoral run with a city council, he might take a look at that poll and say, maybe I should do some of that.
Well, the Ken Sim poll that we'll get into in a second did lead off with the questions, do you think the city's moving in the right direction, yes or no? And if no, how much do you blame City Hall for that? But what I liked about Kennedy Stewart's video is that he pitched the idea of if you don't vote for him, you face, quote, having to endure a right-wing Stephen Harper-style government, which I racked my head a little bit to try to figure out who of Mark Barrison, noted federal liberal, John Cooper, noted conservatory enthusiast, and Ken Sim,
the bagel man.
The bagel man is fits that realm.
I don't exactly know. I assume that he's talking about Ken Sim and trying to make a bogeyman out of Ken Sim, but I don't know. I don't think it's there. Number one, Ken Sim ran last time, and that rhetoric didn't really stick. And number two, Ken Sim is a guy who runs a nursing company. Like, he's not the same kind of beast as Stephen Harper. It's just a weird comparison.
You got to play up the fear rhetoric, I guess. But yeah, this is a real thing. Team Kennedy is happening. There is a Team Kennedy Stewart Vancouver Society that's been registered. I haven't paid to get the society doc, so I don't know who the directors of that are. Probably wouldn't be that informative. It's probably Kennedy Stewart and his
two other people.
Two other people.
So the mayor's race trundles onward with Ken Sim's poll. Now, we get to return, of course, to charts on a podcast, but in this Abacus Data poll commissioned by Ken Sim, Ken Sim would actually beat Kennedy Stewart 34% to 31%.
I do really love the truism of polls that Kennedy Stewart's poll shows that he would win and Ken Sim's poll shows that he would win.
Yeah.
Like, Abacus is a very reputable firm relative to Sutherland and...
Yeah, I think...
No offense to Sutherland, but I just have never heard of you relative.
No, Abacus is a big deal in the polling world. And so far as polls can be accurate, I would trust Abacus as something that is relatively possible to rely upon. Now, one thing that I note is a little weird is Harrison and Cooper, who have each been polling at around 4 to 7% in other polls, are now polling at 1% in this poll.
That's if you include undecideds. If you pull them out, they get 3%. Okay. Still not strong.
It's not strong.
And so this poll includes noted non-candidates Adrian Carr, who comes in at 13%, Sarah Kirby-Young at 7%, Colleen Hardwick at 4%, and Andrea Reimer at 4%.
Yeah, but doesn't that just ruin the poll? I have to at some point wonder why you would include candidates that, one, haven't declared, or two, like, punditry does not expect to run.
Yeah. If Carr doesn't run, enough of those votes will at least will go over to Stewart. Even if you're generous and give all of Sky, Hardwick, and hell, even Marison and Cooper's votes to Sim, then Stewart still has that commanding lead.
Yeah, And so while this poll does paint a prettier picture than previous for Ken Sim, it still does look like Kennedy Stewart is the one to beat.
That said, they did ask respondents what your feeling about the different candidates and potential candidates are, positive, negative, that kind of thing. A lot of people like Adrian Carr, a lot of people like Kennedy Stewart, and a lot of people like Ken Sim. But a lot of people also really don't like Kennedy Stewart. In fact, his net approval rating is negative 18 versus Sim is plus 7. Although, like 44% of people haven't heard of Ken Sim, who ran in the last election.
Yeah. I mean, those 44% of people aren't going to vote, so I think that Ken Sim is actually starting out from a relatively good position so far as things go. Combating the strength of incumbency is always going to be a challenge, and so it's obviously going to be a bit of an uphill climb for him, but that net positive compared to Stewart's net negative lends itself to some opportunities further down the road for both Sim and then the other candidates, Marison and Cooper.
Yeah, they just have to convince people to like them who have never heard of them, versus Kennedy Stewart has to convince people who don't like him to like him, or at least tolerate him. So, numbers from Ken Sim. I'm sure we'll get more polls throughout the summer because, I don't know, it appears like policy discussions have ended. Remember when Ken Sim wanted to abolish the park board? I mean, he still does, but that was a fun discussion. Let's get more of those ideas.
Yeah. We're just going to be horse racing from now until next October. So stay tuned and I will work on my track announcer voice.
Well, we do have a conclusion to a horse race in the Burnaby by-election, which ended up being a little bit of a nail biter, a little bit of an upset in a way, as Burnaby Citizens Association candidate Alison Gu did top the ballot, but independent Mike Hillman defeated Gu's running mate, Baljinder Narang, by 124 votes.
It's kind of insane to me because the BCA has been the ticket onto Burnaby Council for ages, like over a decade. The Burnaby Civic Association has been an immensely popular and successful political organization and has managed to win almost every seat in previous elections. The only seat that was not held by Burnaby Civic Association candidates in the last election was Joe Keithley.
And the mayor.
And the mayor, yes, of course, who defeated Derek Corrigan. But of council seats, this is the first since Joe Keithley and the first independent to win a seat in Burnaby for some time.
Yeah, we had kind of written off all the independents. Former BCA councillor Lee Rankin actually also got up there. He got just over 3,000 votes. Mike Hillman, for reference, got 3,200 votes, and Alison Gu got just under 5,000 votes. 19% is all it takes to become actually 12.5% is all it takes to become a Burnaby councillor under our glorious electoral system. Notably, Rankin actually beat one of the Burnaby Green Party candidates, and the other Green candidate only got 1,170 votes and placed ninth out of 14 candidates. So the Burnaby Greens have to be licking their wounds pretty hard after this, and it appears that Keithley won more on his own brand and repeated engagements with electoralism than potentially the strength of the Burnaby Greens.
So, in response to this, Minister of State for Childcare BC and former BCA school trustee Katrina Chen tweeted, "We have not had a right-wing rep on council since 2008. Hillman has ties to conservatives. I am personally concerned about some of his claims and tactics. Burnaby is often proud of how progressive we are as a community. We can do better." This is, of course, a bit of nonsense. While it may be true that Hillman has ties to conservatives, the idea that Burnaby
has... Small C conservatives, to be clear.
She capitalized it.
Oh, yeah.
We have not had a right-wing rep on council since 2008. Given that the right-wing, left-wing axis in municipal politics is effectively broken and useless, I don't really know what she means by this, seeing as how Burnaby was more than willing to sop to developers and prioritize single-family homes over the development of multifamily apartment units, or which were being destroyed at a ridiculous pace under the previous Burnaby Civic Association government.
I think she means every Burnaby councillor has probably held an NDP membership card since 2008.
Ah, and that, of course, being a guarantor of good policymaking.
So for Hillman's clarification, I did go through his LinkedIn and look this up to try to what she might be referring to. He publicly lists that he's worked with the campaigns of Peter Fassbender, Sukh Dhaliwal, Wendy Yuan, Sam Sullivan, Christy Clark, but her NPA campaign, he clarifies, Ujjal Dosanjh, Haiti Fry, Catherine Wittred, and Janine Kanakos. I had to look up Janine. She was a councillor in Delta. But a lot of prominent federal liberals in there, which also makes sense because Hillman is the membership chair for the federal liberals in British Columbia and was formerly the vice president of the British Columbia wing of the federal liberals, and a few BC liberals who span the spectrum of the federal liberals and conservatives.
Yeah, the only person that I see in there being notably conservative is Peter Fassbender, but the provincial liberals like Catherine Wittred, who are generally perceived as being somewhat more on the federal liberal side of things. I did misspeak, of course. Sam Sullivan also identifies as a federal conservative.
Ujjal Dosanjh, by contrast, was provincial NDP premier, briefly, before the party burned his card.
Yeah, I think that might actually even offend Katrina Chen even more than the ties to the federal conservatives is ties to Premier Dosanjh.
But I think it's clear Hillman represents a slightly different politics from the BCA, and that's more what maybe got in Chen's craw than his like far-right views, which I don't think are necessarily evident here. He clearly has some organizing chops, and honestly, winning a by-election here meant getting 3,200 votes, which if you can't do that,
well, maybe
you don't have organizing chops.
It's, I think, worth it to go into some of the policies that were compiled very helpfully by the Burnaby Beacon newsletter. Alison Gu from the Burnaby Citizens Association says that of blanket rezoning, she supports it for mixed building types in single-family housing areas, which is a noted divergence from previous BCA policies. She supports the SFU gondola in a kind of abstract way, in saying that she supports projects that allow for low carbon transportation, while of course remaining opposed to the Trans Mountain expansion. She will prioritize taxpayer money going to infrastructure and services, which is everything.
I guess it's as opposed to council salaries and upper administrators.
Government is a service.
I know. With you, but she would want to see as well more community events and festivals to make Burnaby more fun, which is a weird question because they all kind of say that.
Yes, Hillman, by contrast, is open to zoning that allows gentle densification, which...
What a great buzzword.
Yeah, I love it and am terrified by it at the same time.
But it's gentle, Matthew.
It's gentle densification, but...
It's probably townhomes.
As someone who... favors incredibly destructive densification.
Violent densification. Hillman is in clear support of the SFU gondola, and notably, he's the only candidate who responded to the survey who was not fully opposed to TMX. He says the project is a reality and will work to ensure the focus is on safety.
On taxes, he says there is a need to invest reserve money and not sit on it, and also wants new facilities and focus on parks and recreation to promote more fun.
That would all fit well with Mike Hurley's view, as far as I can tell, in terms of Burnaby had this giant pot of unspent asset money. Let's build Burnaby some assets.
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty fair and pretty reasonable thing to believe, especially if there is a concern over tax rates in the city of Burnaby. I'm not sure that there necessarily is, but the...
There's a concern over tax rates in every municipality where people have to pay taxes, even though statistically Metro Vancouverites, and I say this as someone who had just had to sign a check for $3,500 for the taxes on my home, still pay a lot less in property taxes than most Canadians. I know houses in Ottawa, for example, can pay $5,000 or $6,000 a year in taxes. I mean, they have to plow a lot more snow than we tend to, but I don't know. I guess we have to now I guess the cities aren't responding to wildfire smoke, so they don't spend any money on that. But we have services, too.
Yeah.
Or we could do.
In other political party news, New West Vancouver political parties have sprung into existence. This one explicitly NIMBY in its outlook.
This party is called Civics West Van, CIVIX, and everywhere on their website they do hashtag West Van. I don't know why. The party is the brainchild of notable West Van resident Nigel Malkin. Malkin was most famous for the campaign to stop the Beeline from crossing the Capilano River.
Arch NIMBY Nigel Malkin, who some of you may remember from that period which spawned the term Huck Finn of Dunderave, is promoting a 9-point platform, which you can donate $10 to support a specific statement that focuses on conserving a livable seaside village, not city notably, but village.
I believe it's still technically a district.
Yeah, it's a district municipality or corporation of West. I'm almost certain it's the Corporation of West Vancouver.
Part two of their platform is to preserve our quality of life. These first two were very vague. It's the later ones that are more fun.
Thank God for that second one, though, because I was worried that they were very specifically looking to destroy our quality of life.
They're going to implement direct democracy, Matthew, and they specifically talk about citizens' referendums that would be binding on council, or at least council would have to follow them.
And this is where I threw up in my mouth, because direct democracy is fundamentally illegitimate. It's not a good way to run anything. And while there may be reasons for societies to occasionally do it, just because the members should control a society, there is no reason for any government anywhere to operate in terms of a referendum. I know that's not a necessarily popular standpoint, that little bit of absolutism, but there just no good reason to, you know, tie the hands of a government behind their back and subject yourself to a system, a process that can be so easily gamed by the phrasing of a question.
Yes, I think it's the opposite almost of deliberative democracy, of efforts to slow down decision making so it can be done more rationally and engage people on a deeper level. Instead, it's like an instinctual appeal to our most reptilian brains, like, do you hate the HST? No? Well, do you hate Christy Clark? Then vote this way.
Yeah, and, you know, as someone who...
Or Gordon Campbell.
My former boss was actually in charge of reintroducing the HST, and I remember one interview where she was asked, but what about people of low incomes? Won't this hurt people of low incomes? Yes. We didn't want to do it. The HST was a better system for people of lower incomes. But now we have to. And then the BC Liberal Party went and said, oh yes, we need to pass referenda for transit expansion. And that's why I voted New Democrat in the last provincial election.
I just can't even imagine how badly a series of local referendums on zoning issues, which is something they specifically flagged later in their platform, would go. Like, the average public hearing is bad.
Yeah. So just imagine having an entire municipality run by public hearing.
The next platform plank is almost better, almost more hilarious, in that it says explicitly West Van needs to, quote, stop excessive population growth.
This is notable because West Vancouver's population declined from 42,694 to 42,473 between 2011 and 2016, a decline of 0.5%. This is at a time when Metro Vancouver increased by 6.5%. So definitely a solution in need of a problem there.
There are just too many people thinking about not leaving West Van.
They also state, in mentioning this, that public transit is impractical for 70% of residents. So population
because they're too rich.
That doesn't mean it's... I'm just going to say, that doesn't mean it's impractical. That just means it's distasteful.
And they also refuse to think about all of the servants and people who they hire to come mow the lawns of their mansions.
They also want to manage their finances responsibly, limit tax increases to inflation. I mean, that's not how the mill rate works.
Even you can make it work that way.
Yeah, I suppose. They also want to enforce compliance with the OCP, local area plans, and current zoning. And in keeping with this, they say that West Van residents should have input on neighborhood character, including holding referendums on significant exceptions.
Contrast that to their desire to respect the local and global environment, a platform plank that has no details on how you can do that while also refusing to accept that development may require density to be efficient.
Yeah.
They just want to have, like, green building standards for the new mansions that can only replace old existing mansions.
They also want to maintain their own homes and community, effectively saying that it's not West Van's job to be affordable.
I mean, they don't say it quite explicitly, but they say it's the rest of the region's responsibility to deal with that.
Yes, it's a very hashtag West Van first attitude towards things. An explicit platform plank to ensure that West Van residents should have priority in all facilities and resources, including schools, recreation programs, parks, and parking.
Platform plank, they title hashtag West Van.
Good for them.
It's always like such a tell when you use the X first language. I think it used to be kind of innocuous, but it's gotten real dirty.
Yeah. I wonder why that is.
No one will ever know. Anyway.
It's unknowable.
Nigel Malkin wants to challenge for mayor. So we'll enjoy watching that fiasco.
Over in Cole Harbor, just across placid waters of Burrard Inlet from West Vancouver, is the Cole Harbor Waterfront Social Housing and Elementary School project, which has been approved by City Council.
This was notable. There was a lot of opposition to this at public hearing. There was almost 100 speakers. Most of them were pretty upset about the like minor increase in density that this required. I think it added 2 floors over what would otherwise be zoned. People were like, sure, there should be a new elementary school in here, but if people have to move here, it will get too busy because everyone who lives in Cole Harbor will drive everywhere.
Yeah, I don't think that that's really a huge concern, given that it's a social housing project. The whole point of moving to a place like Cole Harbor is that you can walk everywhere.
It's really nice, though, to see council kind of stick to their guns and unanimously vote in favor of this. The only vote that wasn't there was Colleen Hardwick, who was absent for this one. She didn't abstain.
Though I have no doubt that she probably would have.
You got Adrian Carr speaking about how much she's excited by it. You got Jean Swanson saying, I love the idea of waterfront housing, and it's a win-win-win.
Now, this is the site of a current parking lot, and it's going to be redeveloped into a 127-foot-tall, 11-story tower. If anyone is wondering about the parking lot, it's the one that you can kind of access of that little traffic loop near the marina that is next to the existing community center and park.
So yeah, this is a really exciting project. Good to see it move ahead. There had been a few road bumps. I think the province had kind of been frustrated by opposition and started to threaten a little bit of Vancouver School Board funding, because Vancouver School Board is also terrible at reprioritizing empty schools and refuses to shut some that might need... Vancouver School Board's not doing any planning, and we'll have to come back to that question. We haven't touched on them for a while.
No, I think that there is some stuff to be hashed out over Vancouver School Board for sure. Now, the particular elementary school is going to be on the first 3 floors of that 11-story building and have room for up to 340 students with the main entrance up on Broughton Street and the seawall. There will also be a childcare facility which will have capacity for up to 64 kids and then 60 units of social housing, 20 more than initially proposed, achieved by a building height increase.
Entire structure is also going to be meeting Passive House and LEED Gold standards, so nice environmentally friendly, sustainable architecture, good stuff to see. Like, the opposition to it is so almost telling on itself, right? This is a social housing space with an elementary. So to oppose this
is to oppose really families with kids and poor people.
Poor people, yeah. So, yeah. Glad to see it move through. Glad to see council come together on this. This is good.
Yeah, a diamond in the rough of what council has achieved, I think.
You don't even call it a home run.
Yeah. You might call it a home run because we might be getting a baseball team. Play ball.
Mayor Kennedy Stewart recently wrote a letter to the Major League Baseball saying, we need to get our name on the list. Let's get running. Let's get on people's radar. He wants a baseball team to come here, a Major League Baseball team, for some reason.
Yeah, exactly why he wants this is not super clear, other than there are some indications that bringing a professional sports team to a city can have positive economic impacts, not necessarily around the stadium itself, but for the general economic vitality of a city. It has worked mostly in places where there has not been a professional sports team before. I think specifically of Oklahoma City and the Thunder, which some might discount as being primarily, at least the cause of Oklahoma City's growth being tied to the massive boom in shale oil that was occurring at the same time, or the Indianapolis Colts, which was stolen hilariously from Baltimore in the middle of the night.
A knock against Kennedy's pitch here is the fact we don't actually have a stadium or even necessarily an ideal location for a stadium. Like, if you look at a map of the city, where are you going to drop what ends up being a fairly massive structure?
Yeah, they're not going to be playing at Nat Bailey.
As nice as Nat Bailey is, it doesn't hold that many people, and it's kind of awkward to get to.
Yeah, a Major League Baseball stadium needs to be huge, and it would take that entire park. You would basically need to tear down the Hillcrest Community Center.
I think the idea I tossed around in the Slack when this was being discussed was just like, there's a lot of space in Shaughnessy. You could displace very few people to actually do it. And if you did it along Granville there, you could probably actually get it next to a major arterial. You could get reasonable SkyTrain access. I don't see a downside.
You have convinced me. I am in favor of this.
Oh. Tear down Shaughnessy, build baseball.
So, in particular, this is coming about partially because the Oakland Athletics are trying to get a new stadium built and unsure whether they can get it done in their own city, where they have lived or called home since 1968. The Major League Baseball head office has recently given the team their blessing to look at relocating. In the best case scenario, this is probably going to mean getting a trip to Vancouver from the Oakland A's and getting Vancouver into the queue for a relocated team or expansion team down the road.
So, if they moved here, would they be the Vancouver A's, but E-H-S?
I think that they should be. I think that's obviously marvelous.
Like,
go ahead.
The one thing, like, it's such a weird political move for Kennedy Stewart, other than, like, maybe just he personally does like baseball, and the opportunity was fine to write a letter. But, like, I was thinking about it, and if Kennedy is going to go for a major sporting brand that fits the, you know, rhetorical progressivism of his leadership, why would he not go for the WNBA, Women's National Basketball Association? Like, get black women into town. He could take a knee with them.
Yeah. One thing that is a little perplexing is, like, who would own this particular franchise? Like, I can't imagine the city ponying up a bunch of money to own a Major League Baseball franchise. It doesn't seem like, unless the city felt like trading a bunch of land in its land bank for this kind of thing, doesn't seem.
That's a pretty hefty investment to take. I think there are a couple municipalities around the world that own sport teams. There's a few other models, like, I think the Green Bay Packers are famously a cooperative ownership structure.
Yes.
But generally you just have, like, one rich guy or company buys it.
Mm-hmm. and then manages it into the ground if you are Vancouver. Coming up on 11 years now, Aquilini's. It's a dark time for the Canucks. That's not what we are going to be wrapping up our Vancouverada, the way we end every episode with a tidbit of Vancouver history, is in fact going to be an event that took place right after a prolonged period of intense heat, the Great Vancouver Fire.
Back in 1886, their June was unseasonably hot and dry. It sounds quite familiar. Nevertheless, some intrepid city staff and crews for Canadian Pacific Railway were eager to expand the buildable land on the Vancouver Peninsula, as there were too many trees in the way. And the most efficient way they figured to do that was through land clearing fires. So they set one off, it got a little out of control.
And in response, they set another one.
And between them, they burned down the township of Vancouver.
Yes, so this fire, because of the wind, got out of control and killed at least 21 people and destroyed 600 to 1,000 buildings. Now, this was such a large fire in a period that is, for Vancouver, effectively prehistoric, that there are not particularly good numbers on how many people were killed or how many buildings were destroyed. Most people escaped by fleeing to the Burrard Inlet or to the False Creek shore, but unfortunately 21 people at least were caught up in the conflagration and set ablaze.
There's some famous stories out of this period of those people who jumped into the water, into the Burrard Inlet to save themselves, and the Squamish people, and I think it was particularly Squamish women on the North Shore, seeing this and seeing the need for help and rowing their canoes over and saving, pulling people out of the water as one of those moments of working together and just putting humanity ahead of all of the racism.
So the primary firefighting tools that were being used at the time were wet blankets, shovels, and buckets. So while this actually managed to achieve the goal of the fires, it came at an incredibly high cost, and it ended up being the last clearing fires that were set up in the city, given the disastrous consequences of these two. They both eventually grew out of control and consumed a large part of the Vancouver township, including basically all of what was called the East End Forest, which is now an area basically Strathcona.
The manager of the Hastings Mill, Richard Alexander, announced the day after the fire he would give free lumber to anyone who was trying to rebuild their homes or businesses, a great act of charity and support. The aftermath was, I imagine, quite the sight, as city council was set up in a temporary tent city hall. Many individuals were having to live out of tents for quite a while until they had new housing built. Even the police operated out of tent city hall until town was rebuilt.
Now, this actually spurred a bit of urban reform and urban development to promote the growth of the city. The CPR became increasingly important in terms of city development, and for a while was the largest single property owner in the city. Even with the Vancouver fire, the population of Vancouver continued to grow, expanding from, at the time, several hundred people to 2,000 people within a year of the fire and 13,000 people within 6 years.
The rush was definitely on in those days.
Yes. Fire or no, this wonderful city by the sea maintains its allure all the way from 1862, when European settlement began, through to the present day. And I think that brings us to the end of the Tuesday, July 6th edition of the Canby Report. There are only 466 days left until the Vancouver municipal election, and apparently we are starting out with a horse race. We are going to get through this, everyone. Thank you all for listening, and good afternoon.